into my heart, and he'll be the one I like more than anyone else. So, one day during that accursed time, the gate to our garden opened. It was, as I recall, a pleasant fall day. She was out, and a man came through the gate who had some sort of business to discuss with my landlord. After it was over, he came down into the garden and quickly introduced himself to me. He said he was a journalist. I took such a liking to him that, imagine, I sometimes think of him even now and miss him. So we got to be friends, and he started to visit me. I found out he was a bachelor and lived next door in an apartment very like mine, but that he felt cramped there, and so on. He never invited me over. My wife took an extreme dislike to him, but I stood up for him. She told me, "Do as you like, but that man strikes me as repulsive." That made me laugh. Yes, but strictly speaking, what was it about him that made him so appealing to me? The fact is that a man who has no surprises inside, up his sleeve, is uninteresting. But Aloisi, oh, I forgot to say that my new acquaintance was named Aloisi Megaric, did have a surprise up his sleeve. Namely, that up until then I had never met, nor did I think I ever would meet, someone with a mind like his. If I didn't understand the meaning of some remark in the paper, Aloisi explained it to me in literally a minute. And it was obvious that such explanations came easily to him. It was the same with things and issues in everyday life. But that was the least of it. Aloisi won my heart because of his passion for literature. He didn't rest until he had persuaded me to let him read my novel from cover to cover. Moreover, his response was very flattering. But he said everything the editor had said to me about the novel with striking precision, just as if he'd been there himself. He hit the mark 10 times out of 10. He even explained to me, and I suspect faultlessly, why my novel couldn't be published. He didn't mince words either. Such and such a chapter will not do. The articles, take note, did not cease. The first ones made me laugh, but the more of them there were, the more my attitude to them changed. The next stage was amazement. There was something uncommonly fake and uncertain in every line of these articles, despite their threatening and self-assured tone. I kept thinking, and I couldn't rid myself of the thought, that the authors of these articles weren't saying what they wanted to say, and that that was why they were so furious. And then imagine a third stage set in. Fear. No, not fear of the articles, mind you, but fear of things totally unrelated to either the articles or the novel. For example, I started being afraid of the dark. In short, the stage of mental illness had set in. It seemed to me, especially when I was going to sleep, that some octopus with supple and cold tentacles was stealing up to me, coming straight from my heart. So I had to sleep with the light on. My beloved had changed greatly. Naturally, I didn't say a word to her about the octopus, but she could see that something was wrong with me. She'd become thin and pale, had stopped laughing, and was always asking me to forgive her for advising me to publish the excerpt from the novel. She said that I should give everything up and spend what remained of the 100,000 on a trip south to the Black Sea. She was very insistent. And so, as to avoid a quarrel with her, something told me that I wouldn't make it to the Black Sea. I promised to do it right away. But she said she would get me the ticket herself. Then I took out all my money, that is, around 10,000 rubles, and gave it to her. "Why so much?" she asked me in amazement. I told her something about my being afraid of thieves and wanting her to take care of the money for me until my departure. She took it, put it in her bag, and began kissing me, saying that she would rather die than leave me alone in the condition I was in, but that she was expected at home, was bowing to necessity, and would be back the next day. She begged me not to be afraid of anything. That was at dusk, in mid-October. And she left. I lay down on the couch and fell asleep without turning on the light. I woke up with the feeling that the octopus was nearby. Fumbling around in the dark, I barely managed to put on the light. My pocket watch said it was 2 a.m. When I went to bed, I felt as if I was getting sick, and when I woke up, I was sick. It suddenly seemed to me as if the autumn darkness would break through the window panes and pour into the room, and that I would drown in it as in ink. When I got out of bed, I was no longer in control of myself. I let out a scream and thought of running to someone for help, if only to my landlord upstairs. I struggled with myself the way a madman does. I had just enough strength to crawl over to the stove and light the wood. When the logs began to crackle and the stove door began to knock, I seemed to feel a little better. I ran out into the hallway and turned on the light. Then I found a bottle of white wine, uncorked it, and started drinking it straight out of the bottle. That helped my fear abate somewhat, enough at least to stop me from running off to my landlord and to return to the stove instead. I opened the stove door so that the heat began to warm my face and hands, and I whispered, "Guess that something awful has happened to me. Come to me. Come. Come." But nobody came. The fire roared in the stove, and the rain beat against the windows. Then came the final blow. I took the heavy typescripts and notebook drafts of the novel out of the desk drawer and started to burn them. It's a fiendishly difficult thing to do because paper that has been written on doesn't burn easily. I broke my nails, tearing the notebooks apart. Then I stood the pages upright between the logs and jabbed at them with the poker. At times, the ashes would get the best of me and choke out the fire, but I fought back, and the novel, despite stubborn resistance, was perishing. Familiar words flashed before me, and a yellowness crept relentlessly up the pages, but you could still make out the words. They disappeared only when the paper turned black, and I beat them viciously with the poker. It was then that someone began scratching softly at the window. My heart gave a leap. I hurled the last notebook into the flames and rushed to open the door. Brick steps led up from the basement to the door into the yard. I stumbled up to the door and asked quietly, "Who's there?" And a voice, her voice, answered me. "It's me." I don't remember how I managed the key and chain. The minute she stepped inside, she fell against me, completely soaked, shivering, with wet cheeks and tousled hair. The only thing I could say was, "Is it you?" And then my voice broke, and we ran downstairs. She left her coat in the hall, and we went quickly into the first room. She let out a soft cry, and with her bare hands threw what was left in the stove onto the floor. A packet of sheets burning on the bottom. Smoke immediately filled the room. I stamped out the flames, and she threw herself on the couch and started to cry convulsively and uncontrollably. When she calmed down, I said, "I came to hate that novel, and I'm afraid. I'm sick. I'm terrified." She got up and started to speak. "My God, you are sick. Why did you do it? Why? But I'll save you. I'll save you. What's this all about?" I saw her eyes, swollen from smoke and tears, and I felt her cold hands stroking my forehead. "I'll cure you. I'll cure you," she murmured, clutching me by the shoulders. "You'll reconstruct it. Why, oh, why didn't I keep a copy myself?" She bared her teeth in fury and said something else that I couldn't make out. Then, with her lips pursed, she started gathering and sorting the burnt pages. It was a chapter from the middle of the novel. I don't remember which. She stacked the pages neatly, wrapped them in paper, and tied them with a ribbon. All her movements showed decisiveness and self-control. She asked for some wine, and after drinking it, began to speak more calmly. "This is what we get for lying," she said. "And I don't want to lie anymore. I'd stay with you right now, but that's not the way I want to do it. I don't want to leave him with the memory of my running off at night. He never did me any harm. He was called out suddenly. There was a fire at his factory, but he'll be back soon. I'll tell him everything in the morning. I'll tell him that I love someone else, and then I'll come back to you forever. Tell me, though, perhaps that isn't what you want. My poor thing. My poor dear, I said to her. I won't let you do that. Things will go badly for me, and I don't want you to perish with me. Is that the only reason? She asked, drawing her eyes close to mine. The only one. She became terribly animated, pressed herself against me, wrapped her arms around my neck, and said, I will perish with you, and I'll be back with you in the morning. The last thing that I remember in my life is the strip of light coming from the entryway. And in that light, a loosened curl, her beret, and her eyes full of determination. I also remember a black silhouette in the outer doorway, and a white package. I'd see you home, but I don't have the strength to come back here alone. I'm afraid. Don't be afraid. Just be patient for a few hours. I'll be back with you in the morning. Those were her last words in my life. Shh! The sick man interrupted himself suddenly and raised his finger. This moonlit night is restless. He disappeared out onto the balcony. Yvonne heard the sound of wheels in the corridor and a faint cry or sob. When everything had quieted down, the guest came back and told Yvonne that room 120 had a new occupant. Someone had been brought in who kept asking to have his head returned. An anxious silence passed between the interlocutors, but once they calmed down, they returned to the story that had been interrupted. The guest was about to open his mouth, but the night was indeed a restless one. Voices could still be heard in the corridor. And the guest whispered in Ivan's ear so quietly that what he was saying was heard only by the poet, with the exception of the opening sentence. 15 minutes after she left me, there was a knock at the window. What the sick man was whispering into Ivan's ear obviously made the sick man very upset. Convulsive spasms kept contorting his face. Fear and fury swam and raged in his eyes. The storyteller pointed toward the moon, which had long since disappeared from the balcony. Only after all the outside noises ceased did the guest move away from Yvonne and start speaking a little more loudly. Yes, so there I was in my yard in the middle of January, at night, wearing the same coat, but with the buttons torn off, shivering from the cold. Behind me were snow drifts, covering the lilac bushes. And in front of me and down below, my feebly lit, blind-covered windows. I leaned over and listened at the first window. A phonograph was playing inside my apartment. That was all I could hear. And I couldn't see anything. After standing there for a while, I went out through the gate into the lane. The snow was falling heavily. A dog dashed under my feet and frightened me, and I ran across the street to get away from it. The cold and the fear, which had become my constant companion, had brought me to the breaking point. I had nowhere to go. And the simplest thing for me to do, of course, would have been to throw myself under one of the streetcars that passed along the main street at the end of my lane. I could see those light-filled, iced-over boxes in the distance and could hear the ghastly grating sound that they made on the frost and ice. But, my dear neighbor, the whole point was that fear had invaded every cell in my body. And I was as afraid of the streetcar as I had been of the dog. Yes, my illness is the worst in the building, I assure you. But you could have let her know, said Ivan, sympathizing with the poor patient. Besides, didn't she have your money? Naturally, she kept it, didn't she? Don't worry, of course she kept it. But you don't seem to understand me. Either that or I've lost the facility I once had for describing things. However, I don't miss it very much, since I have no further use for it. If I had let her know... The guest stared reverently into the darkness of the night. The letter she received would have come from an insane asylum. How can you send letters with an address like that? A mental patient? Surely you're joking, my friend. Make her unhappy? No. I'm not capable of that. Ivan could offer no objection to that, but he sympathized with his guest in silence and felt compassion for him. And the latter, feeling the pain of his memories, nodded his black-capped head and said, "Poor woman. But I'm hoping that she's forgotten me."
"But you may get well," said Ivan timidly.
"I'm incurable," the guest replied calmly. "When Stravinsky says that he'll bring me back to life, I don't believe him. He's humane and simply wants to comfort me. I don't deny, by the way, that I'm much better now. But where was I? Oh, yes, the ice and cold, the speeding streetcars. I knew that this clinic had already opened, and I set out for it on foot across the whole city. What madness! I would certainly have frozen to death when I got outside the city if a chance occurrence hadn't saved me. A truck had broken down about 4 kilometers outside the city, and I went over to speak to the driver. To my surprise, he took pity on me. He was on his way here, and he gave me a lift. The worst thing that happened to me was that I got frostbite on the toes of my left foot, but they fixed that. And this is my 4th month here. And you know, I don't find it so bad here. Not bad at all. One really shouldn't make big plans for oneself, dear neighbor. Take me, for example. I wanted to travel around the globe. Well, it turned out that wasn't meant to be. I can see only an insignificant little piece of it. I don't think it's the best piece of it either, but as I said, it's not so bad. Summer will be here soon, and the balcony will be covered with ivy, just as Praskovya Fyodorovna promises. Having her keys has given me new possibilities. There'll be a moon at night. Ah, it's gone. The air is fresher. It's getting on past midnight. It's time for me to go.
Tell me, asked Ivan, what happened next to Yeshua and Pilate? Please, I want to know.
Oh, no, no, the guest answered, twitching painfully. I can't think of my novel without a shudder. Your friend from Patriarch's Ponds could have done it better than I. Thanks for the conversation. Goodbye. And before Ivan could realize what was happening, the window grill shut softly, and the guest was gone.
Chapter 14. Praise be to the rooster. His nerves couldn't take it, as they say, and Rimsky ran off to his office without waiting for the police to finish their report of what had happened. He sat at his desk and stared with swollen eyes at the magic 10-ruble bills that lay before him. The financial director was at his wit's end. A steady roar rose from the street as the public streamed out of the theater. The financial director's overly sensitive ears suddenly heard the sharp trill of a police whistle, which is hardly ever a good omen. When that sound was repeated, and then accompanied by another more imperious and prolonged one, only then to be joined by loud cackles of laughter and hoots, the financial director knew immediately that something scandalous and nasty had happened outside. and that, however much he wanted to brush it aside, it was intimately connected with the disgusting show put on by the black magician and his assistants. The quick-witted financial director was not mistaken. No sooner had he looked out the window onto Sadovaya Street than his face became distorted, and he said, in a hiss rather than a whisper, "I knew it." In the bright light of the high-intensity street lamps, he saw on the sidewalk below a woman wearing nothing but a chemise and violet drawers. True, there was a hat on her head and an umbrella in her hands. Milling around the woman, who was completely distraught and alternately crouching down or trying to run away, was an excited crowd cackling in a way that sent shivers down the director's spine. Hovering next to the woman was a man struggling to get out of his summer coat, who was so upset that he was unable to extricate his arm from the sleeve. Cries and screams of laughter also came from another direction, from the motor entrance on the left, and when he turned to look, Grigory Danilovich saw another woman, this time in pink underwear. She jumped from the pavement to the sidewalk in an effort to hide herself in the entranceway, but her way was barred by people streaming out of the theater. Victimized by her own frivolity and her mania for clothes, and deceived by Fagot and his vile company, the poor creature dreamed of only one thing, falling through the earth. A policeman was headed in her direction, drilling the air with his whistle, and behind the policeman came a pack of cheery young men wearing caps. They were the ones cackling and hooting. A thin mustachioed cabbie drove up to the first naked woman and reined in his bony, broken-down nag with a flourish. The cabbie's whiskered face was plastered with a grin. Rimsky hit his head with his fist, spat, and moved away from the window. He sat at the desk for a while, listening to the noise from the street. The whistling reached full pitch at various points and then started to subside. To Rimsky's surprise, the scandal came to an unexpectedly speedy conclusion. The time to act was approaching. He would have to drink the bitter cup of responsibility. The telephones had been repaired during the third part of the program, and he had to make calls, report what had happened, ask for help, lie himself out of any responsibility, blame everything on Likhodyeyev, get himself off the hook, and so forth. Confound you, devil! Twice the flustered director put his hand on the receiver, and twice he picked it up. And suddenly, the deadly silence of the office was shattered by the sound of the telephone itself, blasting in the financial director's face. He shuddered and grew cold. "Boy, my nerves are really shot," he thought, and picked up the receiver, whereupon he recoiled and turned white as a sheet. A soft, but at the same time insinuating and depraved, female voice whispered into the phone, "Don't make any calls, Rimsky, or you'll be sorry." The phone then went dead. Feeling his flesh crawl, the financial director put down the receiver and glanced for some reason at the window behind his back. Through the sparse and barely green branches of the maple tree outside the window, he glimpsed the moon slipping behind a translucent cloud. Inexplicably transfixed by the branches, Rimsky stared at them, and the more he did, the more strongly he felt the grip of fear. Making an effort to regain his composure, the financial director finally turned away from the moon-filled window and got up. To call anyone was now out of the question. And the financial director had only one thought on his mind, to get away from the theater as fast as possible. He listened. The building was silent. Rimsky realized that he had been all alone on the second floor for some time, and the thought filled him with an uncontrollable, childlike dread. When he thought of having to walk down the empty corridors and go down the staircase alone, he shuddered. He feverishly grabbed the hypnotist's 10-ruble bills off the desk, stuffed them into his briefcase, and coughed in order to build up his courage. The cough came out, sounding hoarse and feeble. And here it seemed to him that a smell of damp decay had suddenly seeped under the office door. A shudder ran down the financial director's spine, and a clock chimed suddenly and began to strike midnight. Even that made the financial director shudder. But his heart really sank when he heard a key turning softly in the lock. The financial director clutched his briefcase with cold, damp hands and felt that he would not be able to contain himself and would burst out screaming if the scraping in the keyhole lasted one more minute. Finally, the door yielded to someone's push, opened, and who stepped quietly into the office but Varenuha? Rimsky's legs buckled beneath him, and he plopped down into his chair. Sucking air into his lungs, he smiled a kind of ingratiating smile and said softly,
"God, what a fright you gave me."
Indeed, that sudden appearance could have frightened anyone, and yet at the same time, it came as a great joy. At least one small thread in this tangled business had unraveled.
"Well, get it out, tell me." "Well," rasped Rimsky, pulling at the thread, "what's the meaning of all this?"
"Please forgive me," the man who had come in replied in a hollow voice, closing the door. "I thought you had already left." Without taking off his cap, Varenuha went over to the armchair and sat down opposite Rimsky at the desk. It must be said, there was something slightly odd about Varenuha's reply, which was immediately picked up by the financial director, who was as sensitive to vibrations as any seismograph in the world. What was going on? Why had Varenuha come into the financial director's office if he had assumed he wasn't there? After all, he had his own office. That was for starters. And second, no matter which entrance Varenuha had used, he would have bumped into one of the night watchmen, all of whom had been told that Grigory Danilovich would be in his office for some time. But the financial director did not dwell on this oddity for very long. He didn't feel up to it.
"Why didn't you call? What was all that nonsense about Yalta?"
"Well, it's just as I said," the manager answered, and he made a smacking sound with his lips, as if he had a toothache. "They found him in a tavern in Pushkino."
"What do you mean, Pushkino? Isn't that right near Moscow? And didn't the telegrams come from Yalta?"
"Yalta like hell. He got the Pushkino telegrapher drunk. They started fooling around, and that meant, among other things, sending telegrams marked Yalta."
"I see, I see. Well, okay, okay," said Rimsky, crooning rather than speaking.
A yellowish light shone in his eyes. A festive vision of Stjopa having to leave work in disgrace formed in his head. He'd be free. Free, at least, of that disaster known as Likhodyeyev. And maybe Stepan Bogdanovich was in for more than just getting fired.
"Give me the details,"
said Rimsky, tapping the paperweight against the desk. And Varenuha began to recount the details. As soon as he had arrived at the place where the financial director had sent him, he had been received right away and listened to with great attention. No one, of course, had ever seriously believed that Stjopa was in Yalta. Everyone now agreed with Varenuha that Likhodyeyev had obviously been at the Yalta restaurant in Pushkino.
"Where is he now?"
asked the agitated financial director, interrupting the manager's account. "Well, where could he be?" replied the manager with a crooked smile. "Naturally, in a drunk tank."
"Of course, of course. Where else?"
And Varenuha continued his story. And the more he talked, the more vivid an impression the financial director formed of Likhodyeyev's long chain of outrageous and disgraceful misdeeds. And each successive link in the chain was worse than the last. Take, for example, the drunken dance with the telegraph clerk on the lawn outside the Pushkino telegraph office to the strains of some idler's accordion. The chase after some women who were screeching in terror, the attempt to start a fight with the bartender at the Yalta, throwing green onions all over the floor of that same Yalta, smashing 8 bottles of dry, white Aydanil wine, breaking the meter of a cab when the driver refused to take him as a passenger, threatening to arrest the citizens who were trying to end his spree. In short, holy terror! Stjopa was well known in Moscow theater circles, and everyone knew that he was hardly a gift to humanity. But what the manager was saying about him now was too much, even for Stjopa. Yes, too much. In fact, much too much. Rimsky's piercing eyes bore into the manager's face from across the desk, and the more the manager talked, the gloomier Rimsky looked. The manager embellished his story with various vile details, and the more vivid and piquant they became, the less Rimsky believed him. When Varanuha reported that Stjopa had gone so far as to resist those who had come to take him back to Moscow, the financial director knew for sure that everything the manager was saying, the manager who had returned at midnight, everything was a lie from beginning to end. Varanuha had not gone to Pushkino, nor had Stjopa himself been in Pushkino. There was no drunken telegraph clerk, no broken glass in the bar. Stjopa had not been tied up. None of it had happened. Once the financial director became convinced that the manager was lying to him, fear crept over his body, starting with his feet. And for the second time, it seemed to the financial director that a putrid, malarial dampness had spread over the floor. Without ever taking his eyes off the manager, who was sitting in the armchair in an oddly contorted way, trying always to stay within the bluish shadow cast by the desk lamp, and rather peculiarly shielding his eyes from the lamplight with a newspaper, the financial director thought of only one thing. What did it all mean? Why would the manager, who had returned too late to see him, be lying to him so blatantly in an empty and quiet building? And a sense of danger, unidentified but imminent, began to take hold of Rimsky's heart. While pretending not to notice the manager's maneuvers and his tricks with the newspaper, the financial director examined his face, hardly listening any more to the tale Varanuha was spinning. There was something that seemed even more inexplicable than the slanderous story of Stjopa's escapades in Pushkino, fabricated for no discernible reason whatsoever. And that something was the change in the manager's appearance and manners. Despite the manager's efforts to keep his face in shadow by pulling the visor of his cap down over his eyes, and despite his maneuvers with the newspaper as well, the financial director did manage to observe a huge bruise that began at his nose and extended across his right cheek. In addition, the manager's customarily ruddy complexion had taken on an unhealthy, chalky pallor. And despite the sultriness of the night, his neck was wrapped in an old striped muffler. If one added to this the manager's new habit, evidently acquired during his absence, of making disgusting sucking and smacking sounds with his lips, the sharp change in his voice, which had become rough and hollow, and the furtive and cowardly look in his eyes, then one could say without hesitation that Ivan Savelyevich Varanuha had become unrecognizable. Something even more disturbing gnawed at the financial director. But however much he strained his already inflamed brain, however much he stared at Varanuha, he couldn't figure out what it was. He was sure of only one thing. There was something weird and unnatural about this combination of the manager and the familiar chair. "Well, eventually he was subdued and shoved into a car," droned on Varanuha, peering out from behind the newspaper and covering his bruise with his palm. Rimsky suddenly stretched out his hand and started drumming his fingers on the table, while at the same time nonchalantly pressing his palm down on the buzzer of an electric bell. Then he froze. A loud alarm should have gone off in the empty building. But the alarm did not go off, and the buzzer sank lifelessly into the desktop. The buzzer was dead, and the bell was broken. The financial director's maneuver did not escape Varanuha, who winced and asked, with a malicious gleam in his eye, "Why did you press the alarm?"
"Habit," was the financial director's hollow reply as he moved his hand away. Then he asked in a shaky voice, "What's that on your face?"
"The car braked, and I hit my face against the door handle," answered Varanuha, turning his eyes away.
"He's lying,"
the financial director exclaimed to himself. Then his eyes widened and bulged crazily as he fixated on the back of Varanuha's chair. On the floor behind the chair there were two intersecting shadows, one blacker and denser, the other faint and grey. The armchair's back and pointed legs cast a clear shadow on the floor, but there was no shadow from Varanuja's head above the chair back. Nor was there any shadow from his feet beneath its legs.
"He doesn't cast a shadow," cried Rimsky to himself in desperation. He started to tremble.
Varanuja glanced furtively behind the chair, following Rimsky's crazed eyes, and realized that he had been found out. He stood up, as did the financial director, and stepped away from the desk, his briefcase clutched in his hands.
"You guessed it, damn you! You always were smart," said Varanuja, smirking maliciously in Rimsky's face.
Suddenly, he sprang to the door and quickly lowered the bolt. The financial director looked around in desperation as he moved over to the window that looked out onto the garden. There, in the moonlight, he saw the face of a naked girl pressed against the glass. Her bare arm stuck through the fortuchka, trying to open the latch on the lower part of the window. The upper part was already open. It seemed to Rimsky that the light in the desk lamp was going out and the desk was tilting sideways. An icy wave swept over Rimsky, but fortunately he found the strength to resist it and didn't fall. He had enough strength left to whisper, but not shout, "Help!" As he guarded the door, Varanuja jumped up and down beside it, staying suspended in the air for a long time, and swaying back and forth. Hissing and smacking his lips, he winked at the girl in the window and pointed at Rimsky. The girl then doubled her efforts and stuck her red head through the fortuchka, stretching her hand out as far as it would go. She scratched at the lower window latch with her nails and shook the window frame. Her hand began to stretch as if it were made of elastic and became covered with a corpse-like greenness. Finally, the corpse's green fingers grabbed hold of the tip of the window latch, turned it, and the casement began to open. Rimsky gave a faint cry, pressed against the wall, and held out his briefcase in front of him as if it were a shield. He knew his end had come. The casement window swung wide open, but it was not fresh night air and the fragrance of the linden trees that wafted into the room. It was the smell of the grave. The dead girl stepped onto the windowsill, and Rimsky could clearly see patches of decay on her breast. And at that moment, the unexpected and joyous crowing of a rooster was heard coming from the garden, from the low building behind the shooting gallery where the performing birds were kept. The trained rooster was raucously trumpeting the news that dawn was advancing on Moscow from the east. Savage fury distorted the girl's face, and she rasped out a curse. Over by the door, Varanuja let out a screech and fell down from the air onto the floor. The rooster crowed again, the girl grated her teeth, and her red hair stood on end. At the third cock crow, she turned and flew out of the room. And right behind her came Varanuja, who jumped up in the air, assumed a horizontal position like a flying cupid, and floated slowly over the desk and out the window. His head as white as snow, with not one black hair left, an old man, who not long before had been Rimsky, ran over to the door, undid the lock, opened the door, and started running down the dark corridor. Stricken with terror and moaning, he felt for the switch at the top of the staircase and turned on the light. Trembling and shaking, the old man fell on the stairs because it seemed to him that Varanuja was softly collapsing on him from above. When he got to the bottom of the stairs, Rimsky saw the night watchman asleep on a chair by the box office in the lobby. He tiptoed past him and slipped out through the main door. Once he was outside, he felt a little better. He was sufficiently in command of his senses to realize, when he clutched his head, that he had left his hat behind in the office. Needless to say, he did not go back for it, but ran across the wide street, gasping for breath, to the movie theater on the opposite corner, where nearby a dim red light could be seen. A minute later, he was at the taxi, before anyone else could intercept it. "To the Leningrad Express. You'll get a tip," said the old man, breathing heavily and clutching his heart.
"I'm on my way to the garage," said the driver with loathing, and turned away.
Then Rimsky unfastened his briefcase, pulled out 50 rubles, and thrust them at the driver through the open window. Minutes later, The rattling car was rushing like a whirlwind along the Sadovia Ring. The passenger was jounced about on the seat, and when he looked into the rear-view mirror, he caught glimpses of the joyous look in the driver's eyes and the crazed look in his own. Rimsky jumped out of the car in front of the station and shouted at the first person he saw, who was wearing a white apron and a badge, "One first-class ticket. Here's 30 rubles." Whereupon he crumpled and pulled the 10-ruble notes out of his briefcase. "If there's no first class, then second, and if not that, then third." The man with the badge turned to look at the clock and grabbed the rubles out of Rimsky's hands. 5 minutes later, the express train pulled out of the glass-domed station and vanished into the darkness. And along with it vanished Rimsky. Chapter 15. Nikanor Ivanovich's Dream. It's not hard to guess that the fat man with the purple face who had been put into room number 119 at the clinic was Nikanor Ivanovich Bosoy. Before coming to Professor Stravinsky, however, he had spent some time in another place. Very little of that other place remained in Nikanor Ivanovich's memory. All he could remember was a desk, a bookcase, and a couch. The people there had tried to engage Nikanor Ivanovich in conversation, but since his head was spinning from an influx of blood and from extreme emotional distress, the conversation had been strange and muddled. In fact, it had not really been a conversation at all. The first question Nikanor Ivanovich had been asked was, "Are you Nikanor Ivanovich Bosoy, chairman of the House Committee at 302B Sadovaya Street?" Which made Nikanor Ivanovich burst out into a horrible cackle and answer, "Of course I'm Nikanor Ivanovich. But what the devil kind of a chairman am I?" "Meaning what?" they asked Nikanor Ivanovich with narrowed eyes. "Meaning," he replied, "that if I were a real chairman, I would have seen immediately that he was an evil power. How else can you explain it? The cracked pince-nez, his being dressed in rags. What kind of a foreign interpreter looks like that?"
"Who are you talking about?" they asked Nikanor Ivanovich.
"Korovyov," cried Nikanor Ivanovich. "The one who's moved into apartment number 50 in our building. Write it down, Korovyov. You have to catch him right away. Write it down. Entrance number 6. That's where he is."
"Where did you get the foreign currency?" they asked Nikanor Ivanovich in cordial tones.
"Almighty God," Nikanor Ivanovich began, "sees everything, and that is the path I should take. I never touched any foreign currency or had the slightest idea what it looked like. The Lord is punishing me for my sins." Nikanor Ivanovich went on heatedly, buttoning and unbuttoning his shirt and crossing himself. "I took bribes, I did. But I took them in our own Soviet money. I took money for registering people in the apartment house. I won't deny it. It happened. Our secretary, Prolezhnev, is a fine one too, that he is. Let's face it, everyone in the house management office is a crook. But I didn't take any foreign currency."
When they told Nikanor Ivanovich to stop playing games and explain how the dollars got into the ventilation shaft, he got down on his knees and rocked back and forth with his mouth open wide as if he wanted to swallow one of the parquet panels.
"Do you want me," he wailed, "to eat the floor to prove I didn't take it? But that Korovyov, he's a devil."
There is a limit to everyone's patience. And a voice was raised behind the desk, hinting to the effect that it was time for Nikanor Ivanovich to start speaking in a human tongue. At this point, Nikanor Ivanovich jumped to his feet, and the room with the couch resounded with his roar.
"There he is! There he is, behind the bookcase! Look at him, smirk! And his pince-nez! Grab him! Sprinkle the room with holy water!"
The blood drained from Nikanor Ivanovich's face. Shaking, he kept making the sign of the cross in the air, rushed over to the door and then back again, started to recite some prayer, and then finally started spouting complete gibberish. It was quite clear that Nikanor Ivanovich was unfit for any kind of conversation. They led him out and put him in a separate room, where he calmed down somewhat and merely sobbed and prayed. Naturally, they made a trip to Sadovaya Street and paid a visit to apartment number 50. But they did not find any Korovyov there, nor had anyone in the building ever seen or heard of any such person. The apartment, which had been occupied by the deceased Berlioz and by Likhodyeyev, who had gone to Yalta, was empty.
and the wax seals hung peacefully and undisturbed on the cabinets in the study. When they left Sadovaya Street, they took with him the disoriented and dispirited secretary of the House Management Committee, Prolyezhnev. In the evening, Nikanor Ivanovich was taken to Stravinsky's clinic. There, his behavior became so violent that they had to give him an injection prescribed by Stravinsky, and it wasn't until after midnight that Nikanor Ivanovich finally fell asleep in room 119, occasionally emitting a deep, anguished moan. But the longer he slept, the calmer his sleep became. He stopped tossing and moaning, his breathing became easier and more even, and he was left alone. Then Nikanor Ivanovich had a dream, which doubtlessly had its source in the day's experiences. The dream began with some people with golden trumpets leading Nikanor Ivanovich most solemnly over to a pair of huge, polished doors. When they got there, his companions saluted him with a kind of fanfare, and then a booming bass was heard coming from on high, saying merrily, "Welcome, Nikanor Ivanovich! Hand over your foreign currency!" Taken totally by surprise, Nikanor Ivanovich noticed a black loudspeaker above his head. Then he found himself inside a theater, with a gilt ceiling, crystal chandeliers, and sconces on the walls. Everything was as one would expect in a small but richly appointed theater. There was a stage draped with a deep cerise velvet curtain with depictions of enlarged 10-ruble gold pieces scattered across it like stars, a prompter's box, and even an audience. What amazed Nikanor Ivanovich was that the audience consisted of men only, and for some reason they all had beards. No less striking was the fact that there were no chairs in the theater, and the entire audience was sitting on the slippery, magnificently polished floor. Feeling out of place in this large and unfamiliar company, Nikanor Ivanovich hesitated for a while and then followed everyone's example and sat down, Turkish style, on the parquet floor, in between a robust, red-bearded fellow and a pale, hairy one. Neither of the two paid much attention to the new arrival. At this point, the soft sound of a bell was heard. The lights went out in the theater, the curtains parted, and an illuminated stage came into view with an armchair and a small table topped by a golden bell. The back of the stage was draped in thick black velvet. An actor wearing a dinner jacket came out on stage. He was young, clean-shaven, very good-looking, and wore his hair parted down the middle. The audience stirred, and everyone turned their eyes to the stage. The actor walked over to the prompter's box and rubbed his hands. "Are you all seated?" he asked in a soft baritone, and smiled at the audience. "Yes, yes," the audience of tenors and basses replied in unison. The actor began thoughtfully. "And how is it you're not bored? That's what puzzles me. Real people are outside on the streets right now, enjoying the spring sun and the warmth, and you're stuck here on the floor in a stuffy theater. Is the program really that interesting?" "However, to each his own," the actor concluded philosophically. Then he changed the timbre and intonation of his voice and boomed out merrily, "And so the next act on our program is Nikanor Ivanovich Bosoy, the chairman of a house committee and the head of a special diet cafeteria. Please come up on stage, Nikanor Ivanovich." The audience responded with friendly applause. Nikanor Ivanovich's eyes bulged with astonishment, and the MC, shielding his eyes from the glare of the footlights, spotted him in the audience and coaxed him tenderly up on stage. And then, without knowing how, Nikanor Ivanovich found himself on the stage. The glare of the colored lights hit his eyes from in front and below, plunging the theater and audience beyond into darkness. "Well, Nikanor Ivanovich, set a good example," began the young actor sincerely, "and hand over your foreign currency." Silence ensued. Nikanor Ivanovich took a deep breath and began quietly, "I swear to God that..." But before he could finish, the whole theater broke out in disgruntled cries. Nikanor Ivanovich was disconcerted and fell silent.
"If I understand you correctly," began the man in charge of the program, "you wish to swear to God that you have no foreign currency?"
He shot Nikanor Ivanovich a sympathetic look.
"That's exactly right. I don't have any," replied Nikanor Ivanovich.
"Of course," said the actor, "but forgive my indiscretion. How, then, did $400 end up in the bathroom of the apartment of which you and your wife are the sole residents?"
"By magic,"
said someone in the darkened hall with obvious irony.
"Precisely so, by magic,"
Nikanor Ivanovich replied timidly, not to anyone in particular, neither the actor nor the invisible audience. And he went on to elaborate.
"An evil power. The interpreter in Czechs planted them there."
And again the audience roared in disapproval. When quiet had been restored, the actor said,
"That fairy tale puts La Fontaine to shame. $400 were planted in your bathroom. You, audience, are all foreign currency speculators. I ask you, as specialists, does this case make sense?" "We are not speculators," shouted various offended parties from the floor, "but it doesn't make any sense."
"I agree with you completely," said the actor firmly. "And I ask you, what sorts of things are planted on people?"
"Babies,"
shouted someone from the floor.
"Absolutely right," affirmed the MC. "Babies, anonymous letters, proclamations, time bombs, and a lot of other things, but $400 isn't one of them, because nobody's that stupid."
And turning to Nikanor Ivanovich, the actor added mournfully and reproachfully, "You're a disappointment to me, Nikanor Ivanovich. I had such faith in you. So then, this particular act has not been a success." The audience began to hiss and boo at Nikanor Ivanovich.
"He's the foreign currency speculator," the audience screamed. "It's guys like that who make us innocent folks suffer."
"Don't chastise him," said the MC softly. "He'll repent." He then turned his blue eyes, brimming with tears, to Nikanor Ivanovich and added, "Well, Nikanor Ivanovich, go back to your place." After this, the actor rang the bell and announced loudly, "Intermission, you scoundrels!" A shaken Nikanor Ivanovich, who, to his surprise, had somehow become part of a theatrical program, again found himself in his place on the floor. Then he dreamed that the theater plunged into total darkness, and the walls were lit up with bright red lights flashing the words, "Hand over your foreign currency." Then the curtains parted again, and the MC said invitingly, "Would Sergei Gayardevich Dunchil please come up on stage?" Dunchil turned out to be a good-looking but very stout man of about 50.
"Sergei Gayardevich," said the MC, "you've been sitting here for more than a month now, and yet you still refuse to hand over the rest of your foreign currency, now when your country is in need of it, and it's of absolutely no use to you. You still refuse to comply. You're an intelligent fellow, and understand all this perfectly, and yet you still don't want to meet me halfway."
"Unfortunately, I can't do anything, since I don't have any more foreign currency,"
Dunchil replied calmly. "Don't you have any diamonds, at least?" asked the actor.
"No diamonds either."
The actor hung his head and looked pensive, and then he clapped his hands. A middle-aged woman emerged from the wings and came out on stage. She was fashionably dressed, that is, in a tiny hat and a coat with no collar. She had an anxious air, and Dunchil stared at her without moving a muscle.
"Who is this woman?" the man in charge of the program asked Dunchil.
"She's my wife," Dunchil answered with dignity as he looked at the woman's long neck with a flicker of disgust.
"We have disturbed you, Madame Dunchil, for the following reason. We wished to ask you if your husband still has any foreign currency."
"He's already handed over everything he had," was her nervous reply.
"Indeed," said the actor. "Well, if you say so. And if he's handed everything over, then we shouldn't keep him any longer, should we? You may leave the theater if you wish, Sergei Gerardovich," said the actor with an imperious wave of his hand. Calmly and with dignity, Dunchil turned and walked toward the wings.
Just 1 minute, the MC stopped him. As a farewell, let me show you one last number from our program. Again he clapped his hands. The black curtains at the back of the stage parted, and out came a beautiful young woman in a ball gown carrying a gold tray, on which there was a thick package tied with striped ribbon and a diamond necklace which gave off blue, yellow, and red sparkles. Dunchil stepped backward, and his face blanched. The audience fell silent. $18,000, and a necklace worth 40,000 gold rubles, announced the actor solemnly, has been kept by Sergei Gerardovich in Kharkov in the apartment of his mistress, Ida Gyerkulanova Vors, who is honoring us with her presence here and who graciously helped us to locate these treasures which, though priceless, are worthless when in private hands. Many thanks to you, Ida Gyerkulanovna. The beauty flashed a toothsome smile and fluttered her thick eyelashes. And hiding behind your mask of dignity, said the actor, now addressing Dunchil, is a bloodthirsty spider, an astounding liar and a cheat. Your 6 weeks of dogged stubbornness has exhausted us all. Go on home now, and may the hell that your wife is preparing for you be your punishment. Dunchil swayed and seemed about to collapse, but a pair of sympathetic hands reached out and steadied him. The curtain then fell and blocked everyone on stage from view. Wild applause so shook the hall that it seemed to Nikanor Ivanovich that the light bulbs in the chandeliers were jumping out of their sockets. And when the curtain went up, there was no one left on stage except the actor. He cut off a second burst of applause, bowed, and said, "The Dunchil who appeared before you in our program represents a typical ass. Why, just yesterday I had the pleasure of telling you how senseless it is to try and keep a secret cache of foreign currency. There are, I assure you, absolutely no circumstances in which you can use it. Take that same Dunchil, for example. He earns a splendid salary and has everything he needs. A beautiful apartment, a wife, and a beautiful mistress. But no, instead of living a peaceful, quiet life, free of unpleasantness, after handing over his foreign currency and precious stones, he, greedy blockhead that he is, ended up being publicly exposed and earned himself a major family crisis as well. This being the case, who will come forward? Nobody wants to? In that case, the next number in our program is that well-known dramatic talent, the actor Sava Potapovich Korolyesov, who has been invited to perform excerpts from The Covetous Night by the poet Pushkin. Korolyesov appeared on stage immediately and turned out to be a tall, beefy, clean-shaven fellow in a white tie and tails. With no preamble whatsoever, he assumed a gloomy-looking expression, raised his eyebrows, and while looking at the gold bell out of the corner of his eye, began reciting in an unnatural voice, "While awaiting a tryst with a sly temptress, the young rake." And Korolyesov told a lot of bad things about himself. Nikanor Ivanovich heard Korolyesov confess how an unhappy widow, moaning, had gone down on her knees before him in the rain, but had failed to touch the actor's hard heart. Up until his dream, Nikanor Ivanovich had not known the works of Pushkin at all, although he had been well acquainted with Pushkin himself, since he made daily use of such expressions as, "Will Pushkin be paying for the apartment?" or, "I suppose it was Pushkin who unscrewed the bulb on the staircase," or, "So Pushkin would be buying the oil, right?" Now that Nikanor Ivanovich had been introduced to one of Pushkin's works, he felt sad and imagined the woman down on her knees in the rain with her orphans, and he found himself thinking, "That Korolyesov must be a real bastard." Meanwhile, Korolyesov, his voice getting higher and higher, continued to repent, and he befuddled Nikanor Ivanovich completely when he suddenly began to address someone who wasn't there and then answered for this invisible person, calling himself in turn Lord, Baron, Father, Son, and addressing himself with both the formal and intimate forms of you.
Nikanor Ivanovich was sure of only one thing. The actor died a horrible death, screaming, "My keys! My keys!" Whereupon he fell wheezing onto the floor while carefully removing his necktie.